This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. If you appreciate local, original, in-depth news and entertainment programming, please support KDLL. Member donations help keep us on the air. And with changes to state and federal budgets, local support is more important than ever. You can visit our website, kdll.org, and click the donate button to make a one-time or recurring monthly donation. Give us a call at 283-8433 or drop a check in the mail to P.O. Box 2111 in Kenai. It's also pick-click-give time for Alaskans. When you apply for your permanent fund dividend, you can choose to support nonprofit organizations doing good work in Alaska, including KDLL. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and apply by March 31st. Local support helps make local public radio possible. Thanks.
Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn about them.
Hello and welcome to Drinking on the Last Frontier. This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, and I'm your host, Bill Howell. Thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. We've got a lot of stuff for this month's show. Besides our regular news, we'll be talking about the activities of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, barley wine beer styles, interviews with various folks, beer and food, and, of course, beer gear. First up, let's get to news. We've got a lot of news this month, some of it good, some of it bad. So let's get started. The construction of King Street Brewing Company's new brewery at the corner of 91st Avenue and King Street in Anchorage is progressing well. New brewing equipment was delivered a couple of weeks ago, and everything looks to be on track for a spring move into its new digs. Meanwhile, it's been announced that a new brewery, Turn Again Brewing Company, will be opening in the location soon to be vacated by King Street. Turn Again Brewing is the dream of longtime Anchorage homebrewers Ted and Mary Rosenwig, a surgeon and a microbiologist, respectively. With King Street moving out but leaving most of its brewing equipment behind as it upgrades, the Rosenwigs were presented with a unique opportunity to purchase a turnkey operation in a building that's already zoned, permitted, and set up for brewing. They want to focus on brewing Belgian style and sour ales and want to adapt traditional Belgian and sour varietals to Alaska raw materials and innovate on classic Euro styles. The brewery will feature two distinct fermentation areas, one for sour ales and one for the more traditional beers. The two need to remain separated to prevent cross-contamination. A major goal, one which they hope to realize some 6 months after opening, is to release a beer in the style of a Flanders red ale. The Rosenwigs should get to move in March and anticipate opening in mid to late April. St. Elias Brewing Company in Soldotna now offers its beers in 32-ounce crowlers, as well as the more common glass growlers. Crowlers are aluminum cans filled and sealed behind the bar using a small canning machine. The brewery offers some pre-filled cans in a cooler for customers in a hurry, or one can be filled to order. Such cans are very popular, being lighter and having better seals than glass growlers, as well as being unbreakable. In addition to its standard pint-sized glasses, St. Elias has also begun offering its beers in half-pint glasses. On January 14th, the Flats Bistro in Kenai held an extremely successful beer dinner in conjunction with Midnight Sun Brewing Company of Anchorage. Each dish was paired with a different beer from the brewery, and the event was a near sellout. Word is that the Flats intends to hold another such dinner in March. Kenai River Brewing Company is planning its own beer dinner for February 14th, the Wednesday before the Frozen River Fest, which will take place on Saturday, February 17th. Speaking of the Frozen River Fest, the Soldotna Chamber of Commerce is asking for volunteers to help at the festival. For festival goers who wish to consume beer, tickets are $20, which gets you a Frozen River Fest mug and two drink tokens, each good for an 8-ounce pour. Non-drinkers are admitted for free. Volunteers work for 2 hours of the 4-hour festival and receive free admission, a mug, and two tokens. You can sign up on the Soldotna Chamber of Commerce's website. At the Great Alaska Beer and Barley Wine Festival, Cassock's Brewery of Nikiski took gold in the barley wine competition with its Buffalo Head Barley Wine for the third year in a row. The silver went to Lower Daboom Barley Wine, produced by 21st Amendment Brewing of San Francisco. The bronze went to Midnight Sun Brewing's Arctic Devil Barley Wine. Elysian Brewing's Will Wheat Wine was chosen as the best winter seasonal beer at the festival. Midnight Sun Brewing's Berserker Russian Imperial Stout was also selected as one of the top 20 wood-aged beers in the country by Beer Connoisseur magazine. We'll have an interview with Frank Cassock of Cassock's Brewing later in the show. The Brewers Guild of Alaska has launched a new website, www.akcraftbeer.com, to highlight legislative issues which could impact Alaska's craft brewing industry. Currently, there are three issues listed: the municipality of Anchorage's proposed 2% alcohol tax, the recent activities by the Alcohol Beverage Control Board regarding, quote, fun activities, end quote, at Alaska's breweries, and SB 76, the proposed revision to the state's alcohol licensing, which I discussed in some detail with State Senator Pete Michicki last month. If you missed that interview, I strongly suggest you listen to the recording of the show available on the KDLL website. If you're interested in supporting craft beer in Alaska, you should probably check out akcraftbeer.com. In 2018, Alaskan Brewing will be changing up its rotating seasonal offerings, launching a new focus that will not be strictly tied to the seasons. The new packages and beers will concentrate on the Alaskan Brew Crew's dedication to local ingredients and brews that are long-standing fan favorites. The new rotating beers will feature labels with iconic symbols of Alaska, with Spruce IPA featuring a snowy owl on its label, debuting in January. Quote, "We have been brewing with Sitka spruce tips for years, and we started getting interested in how well they can complement the hop flavors," said plant manager Curtis Holmes. "In the past, we've used spruce tips in sweeter beers, which brought out a citrus or berry quality, but when used in hoppy beers like IPAs, we found the evergreen and woody character played a more prominent role in producing the complexity of flavors and aromas in our IPA," end quote. Slightly bitter and bracing, a lot like January in Alaska, Spruce IPA is eminently drinkable with aromas of pine and tart berries. The taste maintains a berry-like, fruity, slightly floral and tart quality, but the bitterness brings out the similarities to the hops. Quote, "Over the past few years, as we brewed more beer varieties with Sitka spruce tips, we analyzed how Sitka spruce tips compared to different hop varieties, and we found that there were many similarities between them," remarked David Wilson, quality assurance manager. "Both ingredients contain B. pinene, which imparts a citrus pine character. We try to brew with local ingredients whenever possible, and it's been pretty cool to discover that this indigenous Alaskan tree has some comparable properties to hops," end quote. By using only newly budded springtime tips from the Sitka spruce tree, which have a delicate citrus sweet character, Alaskan Brewing spruce beers have an unmistakable aroma and flavor. Quote, "We think it's a great fit to expand our IPA selection with Spruce IPA this spring, with a nod to our Alaskan roots," Wilson said. At its January 23rd meeting, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board of Alaska voted 3-1 to forbid distillery tasting rooms from serving mixed drinks, despite over 500 pages of public comments opposing the proposed new regulations. Distilleries will be allowed to, quote, separately serve other types of non-alcoholic mixes and garnishes, Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office Director Erica McConnell wrote in an email. That means a distillery could serve a customer two glasses, one with gin and the other with tonic, which the customer could then mix themselves. The Department of Law will receive the proposed regulations next week for review before sending them to the Lieutenant Governor for signature. The regulation becomes effective 30 days after he signs it. In the Alaska State Legislature, Representative Chris Tuck has pre-filed House Bill 269, which amends Alaska Statute 411-170 by adding two new sections. Section F clarifies that a distillery licensee may combine the distillery's product with other ingredients, non-alcoholic mixers and garnishes, for serving for on-site consumption. Section G defines the distillery's product as an alcoholic beverage distilled on the licensed premises. Representative Tuck sponsored the original distillery language bill and has stated that serving of mixed beverages was the original intent of his legislation. The ABC board also took action to restrict the activities allowed in brewery tasting rooms. We'll have more details on that in our next segment. This is Bill Howell, Drinking on the Last Frontier, and we'll be right back here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Hello, and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. This is your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. As I mentioned earlier in the news items, the Alaska Alcohol Beverage Control Board held a meeting in Juneau on January 23rd. One of the major topics of discussion at that meeting was the rules regarding activities taking place in brewery tasting rooms. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the board, there are five members. There's Board Chair Bob Klein of Anchorage, who's in what is called an industry seat. There is Board Member Rex Leith of Wasilla, who holds the public safety seat. There's Board Member Robert Evans of Nome, who holds the rural public seat. Board Member Tom Manning of Juneau, who holds an industry seat, and then finally Board Member Ellen Ganley of Fairbanks, who holds a public seat. The director of the State of Alaska's Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office is Erica McConnell. So we have some audio recorded from the board's meeting. Apologize for the sound quality. It was the best we could do since the meeting was in Juneau. We were recording it over the phone. Initially, you'll hear Director McConnell explaining the issue to the board.
We are seeking the board's guidance on the interpretation of the section in manufacturing licenses that prohibits live entertainment, televisions, pool tables, dart games, dancing, electronic or other games, game tables, or other recreational or gaming opportunities. Some of those items are very clear. We understand what is a television, a pool table, a dart game, et cetera. But what we are asking the board to provide us is an interpretation, some sort of boundaries around what constitutes, in particular, live entertainment and other recreational opportunities. Festivals, fundraisers, painting parties, competitions, I think it was particularly a yodeling competition, yoga classes, poetry readings, art exhibitions, and sales of local crafts. So we are both requesting the board to provide us with an interpretation, and we would also suggest that the board initiate a regulations project to memorialize an interpretation, recognizing that through the regulations project, which would, of course, include a great deal of public comment, what ends up in the regulations project may be different from any interpretation that you provide to us today, but this is something where we are seeking board guidance. It's been very clear through legislative intent that manufacturing licensees are not supposed to act like bars. And there's a number of prohibitions placed on those tasting rooms to effectuate that, including a earlier closing time than bars have, including a drink limit that doesn't exist at bars, including not allowing for stools at any bar in the tasting room, and including this prohibition on a list of activities. Strict is an objective term. So, yeah, I'm sure the licensees feel this is strict. The board is here to provide this sort of guidance to the staff. So if you think I'm too strict, tell me what else to do.
So after Director McConnell explained the issue, board member Ellen Ganley said she thought that the staff recommendation was too strict because none of the activities listed posed an actual danger to the public. But board member Rex Leith, of public safety seat, favored a strict interpretation, saying that tap rooms could just apply for a different license that would allow them to offer entertainment and dispense alcohol if that's what they wanted to do. However, Director McConnell explained that it isn't quite that cut and dried.
In theory, yes, there is a different license they could apply for to be able to do these things. In practical reality, such license may not be available or it may be prohibitively expensive.
Board member Robert Evans didn't want the staff to stray from the strictest possible interpretation while new regulations are being considered.
We should not expand the definition of the way the statute's written. We did this with recreational licenses, and we went down a path where now we're having to relook at the whole recreational license issue and possibly revoke some of those because they're so outside the statute. By starting a regulations project, we are going to allow staff to follow the statute. So, you know, these folks, they just got to follow the rules until the rules are changed.
Enforcement Supervisor James Holzer, part of the staff at the state office, added his two cents, explaining what it's like to decide whether or not to issue a notice of violation, also known as an NOV, to a tap room over these sorts of entertainment issues.
I personally think that it is cut and dry. When you talk specifically about entertainment's definition is the action of providing or being provided with amusement or enjoyment. And then when you add the live in front of it, it kind of narrows it down a little more. But I think that any time when somebody's there performing any type of activity that is there for the pleasure, enjoyment, recreation, relaxation, diversion, or other purpose provided by a person to another person, that would really fit the definition of live entertainment. So I guess it's important for the board to understand where staff, enforcement in particular, is coming from when we have difficulty not receiving any direction from the board and we're left with interpreting this ourselves. A lot of times, it's kind of you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And if we don't write the NOVs for what most people would recognize as live entertainment, we get the questions asked to us, why aren't you guys writing these NOVs? And then when we write the NOVs for live entertainment, then we get it thrown back at us saying, how do you figure that this is live entertainment? I think we've been going long enough with no definition attached to that live entertainment, and it has caused the board to come back and revisit it. And I believe that if the board were to give a rough interpretation of what they feel that includes today and work on a regulations project where it completely cements it so this doesn't become an issue in the future, I think that would be a great way to accomplish this.
Following the discussion, the board voted unanimously to start a regulation project to draft regulations to clearly define live entertainment. It then voted 3-1 in favor, with board member Ganley opposed and Chair Klein abstaining, to direct the staff to continue using a strict interpretation of what constitutes entertainment in a taproom. Per the staff's memorandum of 23 January, that interpretation will be as follows. Quote, active events that are designed to invite patrons to the manufacturing facility for purposes other than tasting the manufacturer's product, including festivals, classes, poetry readings, competitions, craft fairs, and the like, should be considered, quote, live entertainment and or recreational opportunities, end quote, and thus prohibited. If you don't like this interpretation that the board is making in your name, I suggest you make your feelings known to them via the state government website and also via your elected representatives. We'll be back in just a minute with our style segment talking about barley wine style beers. This is Bill Howell, drinking on the last frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna.
Have you ever wondered how much fish we sell on the Kenai, or how much oil comes from here, what it's all worth, and what it all means? Well, we have too. That's why we created Econ 919, a weekly look at the Kenai Peninsula's economy, what makes it work, and who makes it work. Tune in each Friday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. for new numbers, emerging trends, and a bit of trivia. Econ 919, Friday mornings at 9 and again at 5, right here on KDLL, public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. In this month's beer style segment, we'll be talking about barley wines. Barley wine is the strongest style of beer, and while it isn't always literally as strong as wine, it typically is stronger than beers in the styles referred to as strong or old. The first beers we now think of as barley wine sprang from the British farmhouse brewing tradition, with its origins in the mid to late 18th century in breweries attached to the aristocratic great houses of England. At first, such beers were too expensive to produce on a commercial basis. Using new techniques to produce pale malt, these breweries began to brew these beers exclusively for the use of these wealthy households. These beers would be aged in wood for a year or more before serving and were brewed, quote, to answer the like purpose of wine, end quote, at the table. This was considered important in the days when frequent warfare between England and the wine-producing countries in the south could interrupt wine supplies for extended periods of time. In 1854, Bass began production of a single-brew barley wine they called simply Number One, its label adorned with a single red diamond. This diamond was registered as Britain's second trademark, following the still familiar Bass Ale Red Triangle, the first trademark. Bass No. 1 was brewed almost continuously, with a 10-year break from 1944 to 1954, until its discontinuation in 1995. It still remains the standard, though today only in memory, against which other British barley wines are measured. But while the heritage of British-style barley wines is long and distinguished, they are not the only interpretations of this classic style. While its roots are in British traditions, barley wine as a style has enjoyed a substantial second flowering among American craft brewers, beginning with the production of Old Foghorn Ale by Anchor Brewing Company in 1975, followed shortly afterwards by Sierra Nevada Brewing's Bigfoot. For brewers, barley wine is a difficult and expensive beer to produce, requiring great amounts of material, procedural vigilance, and time, which is the vital fifth element, along with malt, hops, water, and yeast, needed to produce a great barley wine. Like its early cousins, old and strong ales, barley wine is intended to be laid down, the fortitude of its flavors sometimes requiring a year or more to mellow into an enjoyable integration. Some versions, such as the legendary Thomas Hardy Ale, can be cellared for 25 years or more. So what does it taste like? Barley wines in the British tradition are typically malt forward, tasting slightly sweet and with plenty of vinous and woody notes. American-style barley wines typically have a much greater hop presence. However, just because a barley wine is produced by an American brewery does not mean it will be in the American style. Plenty of American craft breweries produce English-style barley wines. Either style may also be barrel-aged. If the barrels used previously held some other spirit, that will bring added complexity to the flavor profile. Both styles have strengths ranging from 8% alcohol by volume to greater than 18%. This high strength often means that they will be served in smaller glasses. What foods do they pair well with? The traditional match for an English barley wine is an aged Stilton blue cheese, as the strong flavor of the cheese can stand up to the equally strong beer. Another choice might be a bread pudding, especially one with a sauce that utilized whiskey or rum as its base. American barley wines are bitterer, so they might pair better with a slightly less assertive cheese, say a good cheddar, one aged for at least a year. Or try them with a steak or a burger which has had blue cheese crumbled on it. Finally, they actually make a wonderful pairing with fruitcake. Yes, it may not be widely known, but you can actually eat fruitcake, and I'm sure a nice glass of barley wine would make it even more palatable. If you would like to try a local version of this beer, there are many to choose from. St. Elias Brewing currently has its 2016 Moose Juice Barley Wine on tap. Cassox Brewery offers its Buffalo Head Barley Wine on tap and in 22-ounce bottles. Midnight Sun Brewing in Anchorage offers both its Arctic Devil Barley Wine and its Termination Dust Barley Wine in 22-ounce bottles. However, the White Whale of Alaska Brewed Barley Wines is certainly Anchorage Brewing Company's A Deal with the Devil. This beer has won numerous awards, is barrel-aged for at least a year, and clocks in at over 18% alcohol by volume. Bottles of it are very hard to come by, but if you ever have a chance to sample it, I would advise you not to pass it up. To say that it is sublime is an understatement, and it has to be tasted to be believed. That's it for this month's style section. Next up, we'll have an interview with Frank Cassox of Cassox Brewery to tell us about his gold medal win at the Great Alaska Beer and Barley Wine Festival. This is Bill Howell, Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. And now we've got a quick interview with Frank Cassox of Cassox Brewing. I think we talked to Frank back in our very first episode, almost a year ago. One of the things we talked about at that time was barley wines. So, Frank, congratulations. You guys won first place at the Great Alaska Beer and Barley Wine Festival for the third year in a row. I think that's unprecedented.
Well, thank you. It's quite an honor. It was a huge shock to us to come again back-to-back for the third time. It's not an easy feat, apparently, but we seem to have pulled it off.
Well, congratulations. Did you do anything different with this year's barley wine?
Every year we do something a little bit different. It's my fun brew. We do little twists to make it somewhat a little bit different. It's always been our goal ever since we started competing at the GABBF with presenting this year's barley and not a 2 or 3 year old aged barley.
So you don't do any blending or anything like that? It's all just straight 1 year's brew?
Precisely. We did two batches this year, last year, early 2017, and we aged each batch a little differently with some different barrels and whatnot. And when it came down to it, we sampled everything about a week before the Barley Wine Fest and decided on this batch.
Well, great. Is any of it on the street yet?
We do have a very limited amount in bottles. A little bit is on tap here at the brewery. Basically, there was only about 105 gallons produced of this batch of beer.
So people should look for it there at the brewery if they want it on draft?
Absolutely, yes. All of these bottles and the draft is going to be sold directly out of the brewery.
Cool. So anything else going on? You guys got any other big projects in the offing?
Oh, you know, we're still playing catch up with the six-packs. They've taken off on us tremendously, and we're proceeding along with that. We just keep getting new notices of the new places where the beer's going, and we're just doing nothing but getting busier.
Well, that's great. While I have you here, do you have any comment on the Alcohol Beverages Control Board's decision about tap room rules that they just took the other day?
Yes. It's unfortunate that they're swinging hard against us right now, and we feel that, you know, we're doing okay. We're staying with our program as far as, you know, tasting room goes and not trying to ask for the world. But, you know, when you're just making a living, and that's all we're doing these days, that's our take on it anyway.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to find out that if I decide to do a book signing somewhere, that's going to be considered live entertainment. So I should have to start charging a cover charge for a book signing.
Yeah, that's kind of unfortunate, but yeah. Hopefully everything shakes out. You know, I mean, we have a lot of public support, and hopefully with that public support, things will come out a little better. There's a lot to go yet. There's a lot of discussion to go yet with this.
I think we all hope it turns out with the right answers. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us, Frank. Sure do appreciate it. Congratulations on your third year in a row. That is really amazing and definitely a great feather in your guys' cap.
Thanks again.
Next up on Drinking on the Last Frontier, we'll be talking about beer's place in fine dining. This is Bill Howell, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Let's talk about beer and fine dining. We've all got our pet peeves, the little things that really drive us up the wall. One of mine is sitting down in a nice restaurant and asking to see their beer list, only to be told, "Oh, we have everything." Really? There are over 5,000 breweries in the U.S. alone, so a conservative estimate will be that there are at least 20,000 plus beers brewed in the U.S., not to mention all the cool imports out there. And you've got everything. That's impressive. Okay, I'll have a 1998 Thomas Hardy's Ale. At this point, the poor server usually realizes that they are dealing with a beer geek, and my wife sighs as she is again reminded that she was foolish enough to marry one. The server then admits that by everything, he or she really means Bud, Bud Light, Miller, Miller Light, Coors, Coors Light, etc., i.e. the same run-of-the-mill macro brews that everyone else has. If I'm really lucky, they might have one local brew of some sort on tap or in a bottle. It will probably be served way too cold and may be so old that it does not taste anything like it should, but that's the way it goes, right? Can't expect to get what you're paying good money for, i.e. a quality craft beer. What bothers me most about this is that no self-respecting restaurant would ever respond to a request to see its wine list by saying, "We have everything." Nor would they think serving just a run-of-the-mill house white sufficient to satisfy the tastes of all their customers and pair with all their dishes. But they think nothing of treating beer in such a cavalier fashion. This is especially galling, as beer makes a much superior pairing with most foods as compared to wine. Since beer is carbonated, the effervescence of the bubbles actually allows it to disperse more aromas. Given its myriad of styles, beer is far more versatile at mealtime than wine could ever hope to be. Are you having fajitas? The bracing hoppiness of an English pale ale will cut right through the dish's spiciness. Are you having spinach salad? A nice tangy wheat beer will counterbalance the acidity of the dressing. If you're having chocolate cake, then a bold, roasty imperial stout will balance the richness of your dessert. Beer works across all these categories, which is not the case with wine. However, to quote the great Bob Dylan, "The times they are a-changin'." More and more chefs are discovering the utility of versatility of beer, both as an ingredient in and as an accompaniment to fine dining. True beer lists are becoming more and more common in fine dining establishments, taking their rightful place alongside the wine list. Coming from the other direction, more and more breweries and brew pubs are serving food, and that food is becoming increasingly sophisticated. A couple of decades ago, a brew pub could get away with serving the standard sort of deep-fried pub food, but today's patrons are increasingly looking for something better. If they're going to go to the trouble to seek out quality handcrafted beers, they expect to be served quality handcrafted food as well. We can see the intersection of these trends in the growing popularity of what are loosely called beer dinners, in which each course is accompanied by one or two beers specially selected to go with that course. Under that general umbrella, there are many different subcategories of beer dinner. Some showcase beers from a single brewery, while others might focus on beers from a specific region of the country or even imports from another country, such as Britain or Belgium. I've attended dinners which were billed as a duel between two breweries, in which each course was accompanied by two beers, one from each brewery, and the patrons voted on whose beer paired best with each course. Some dinners focus on aged beers. The famous Humphrey's Beer Dinner, held in Anchorage each year during Alaska Beer Week, showcases hard-to-find brews plucked from the extensive personal cellar of Humphrey's owner Billy Opinski. Whatever the chosen theme for any particular dinner, they all share one thing in common. They are a celebration of the excellence of finely crafted beer and its amazing ability to accompany and enhance delicious food. Here on the peninsula, restaurants are beginning to dip their toes into the beer dinner waters. The Flats Bistro in Kenai recently held its third beer dinner and is planning a fourth for sometime in March. Kenai River Brewing Company has held two such dinners since opening its new tasting room and is planning another for Valentine's Day. Seward Brewing Company also hosted such a dinner last summer. Given the success of these pioneering efforts, it's logical to assume that the opportunities to enjoy beer dinners here on the peninsula will continue to increase. If you're a beer lover like me, you should want to see this trend continue. The way to make that happen is to give feedback. If you love beer and don't wish to see it mistreated, speak up. Let the server and or the manager know if you're not happy with the beer choices at the establishment or how their beers are served. If your complaints are ignored, go spend your money someplace else. Conversely, if you find good beer properly served, let the folks doing so know how much you appreciate it. Go to beer dinners and let the staff and owners know just how happy you are to do so. Positive feedback is just as important as negative feedback. Let's put our money where our mouths are and teach people out there to respect beer. Coming up in our next segment, we'll have an interview with the chef from Kenai River Brewing Company. This is Bill Howell, drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. And we're going to do an interview now with Tyson Jolliffe of Kenai River Brewing Company. You're the chef here.
Yeah.
One of our themes this month in the show is we're talking a lot about beer and food and pairing beer with food and using beer and cooking and things like that. Obviously here at Kenai River, that's one of your main focuses. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about how you go about constructing a menu that pairs well with beer?
Me and Colton both came on board at the same time pretty much when we opened up the food site here at Kenai River Brewing. And Doug is quite involved in inputting some of his information that he knows about beer, and the food side of it is more on our side, but he's pretty involved in, you know, involving beer in as much stuff as we can without everything being involved with beer. Traditionally, people think about pairing food with wine, and we try to involve beer, and one of those things like red wine and beef and white wine and seafood, we kind of go about, it's kind of subjective, you know, darker beers with beef and stuff like that, and, you know, lighter beers with salads and lighter fare. We play around with that. Mostly we think about how much sugar and how much if it's going to reduce down, how thick it's going to be and how flavorful it's going to be once it's reduced, because you're kind of evaporating most of the liquid off. We go about a lot of braising and, you know, slow roasting with beer. And then we make a lot of our sauces. Our cheese sauce has our Kenai River PBR, which is a lighter beer. Our breakfast beer is a heavier beer, which we use in our gravy for our poutine. And our mac and cheese is also made with the cheese sauce. PBR is made for our wing sauce. We involve a sweeter gummy bear barbecue that's made with gummy bears into our barbecue sauce to make it a little sweeter. But we pretty much have free rein to kind of do whatever we want to try to experiment. And we have a special every day, so that's kind of how we utilize our experimental portion of it.
Well, one of the things I've always thought is that beer works much better with food, really, than wine, because beer has so much a larger flavor palette. You know, wine, you've got red and you've got white, and that more or less covers it as far as the big flavors. But beers, you've got everything from sour beers to light beers to hoppy beers to sweet beers to heavy beer, so there's a lot more of a range there. Has that been your experience?
Absolutely, and especially here, you know, this is the first actual brewery that has food that I've worked in that you don't have the traditional, you know, just Bud Light, IPA, you know, Hefeweizen, you know. They actually make all the beers, and I mean, as you can see, we have almost 20 taps every day to utilize, so it gives us a little bit of like you said, range. You know, we have four different beers right now that have different fruit palates. We have four different heavy beers, and then the rest of them are infused with fruit, more hops, like you said, more sweet. You know, so we have a very big range, so we have a lot of different options to play around with.
So when you get ready to put together something like a menu for beer dinner, I know you guys have done those here in the past. What do you think about in that case when you're sort of building an entire meal of multiple courses?
We get our head brewer together and we kind of talk about what we're thinking about food-wise, and we bounce ideas off each other, and they have a little bit more in-depth information about what it will taste like, you know, after you eat something super sour, if you have a sour beer, or if you eat something super sweet and then you have a heavy beer or a light beer, you know, they give us the information to, so we bounce ideas off of that. But we usually try to have a cask, which is usually only brewed one time. We usually try to feature those in our first course, and then our last course is usually kind of tapering down from the first course heavier to, you know, try to finish with a little bit of a lighter beer so it doesn't fill you up so much. Our first beer dinner that we did was a lot of beer and a lot of food, and we got really full really fast. So,
yes, I was at it. It was excellent. Yeah. So I understand, though, you're going to be doing a little kitchen expansion, too, right? Doug has said, and that come the spring.
Yeah. We've been open a little over a year now for the food side, and it's taken off very well, and we've had a lot of good feedback, and we're actually going to knock one wall out and expand the kitchen almost by another half, and it'll give us some more room to play around and have a little bit more room to move around in there. It's a pretty small kitchen for how many people we serve out of here every day, so it's an exciting part for both Doug and us because we'll be able to do a lot more fare and everything out there.
Anything specific you're looking forward to be able to add in with the more space?
Yeah, one of the things that a lot of people do is beer cheese soup, beer cheese sauce, and it's kind of a staple around the country, and a lot of people have kind of brought it to our attention that they'd like to see house-made pretzels with beer cheese. So if we get a mixer, we could possibly do that.
Yeah, my wife's a huge fan of your beer cheese soups, so she really, really loves it. Always wishes it was on the menu every day, every time we come in here. Right. Speaking of your menu, you guys obviously are doing your daily specials, but your standard menu's been fairly static. Do you have any plans in the near future to make any alterations there?
Yeah, once we get the expansion on the kitchen, we're looking at to make the menu a little bit bigger. And like you said, we have had the same menu pretty much static since we've opened, with our daily specials rotating, possibly incorporating a couple more salads and a couple more main dishes, and then possibly, if we have the room, Doug has shown some interest in possibly doing some more smaller plates. We are a brewery, some people come in, if we can get them to just indulge in a smaller plate, that's something that we're going to try to entice people to come in and have a beer and a small plate of food and enjoy themselves.
One final thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the brunch that you guys have been doing lately. So haven't been to one, but looking at it online, it looks like you guys are serving some pretty good food. Has it been going well for you?
Yeah. I actually run the brunch on Sunday with one other person in our kitchen, Jess. And we originally just thought we would do a smaller brunch item one day a week on Sunday just to see if we had interest. And after the first couple, we had a pretty good following and they were very happy with it. We have a rotating stuffed French toast or regular French toast. And then we always have an Eggs Benedict, biscuits and gravy, chicken fried steak. And then we try to rotate in a couple of daily specials. And we've saw some good feedback from, we had huevos rancheros last week. And then we had a stuffed breakfast burrito smothered in gravy. It seems like a good place to come and have a beer and have some brunch. So it works out good.
Well, hey, Tyson, thanks so much for taking the time out on your busy day here to talk with us. We really appreciate it and looking forward to seeing what new concoctions you guys come up with. I've enjoyed everything you've made so far, so please keep up the good work.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Bill Howell here on Drinking the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. We'll be right back with our next segment. Welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Let's check out this month's beer travels. Let's go to Denver, Colorado, home of the Great American Beer Festival. There are a lot of great breweries and beer bars in Denver, but I want to talk about one that stands head and shoulders above the rest, Falling Rock Tap House. My wife and I first visited Falling Rock in 2010. It's located at 1919 Blake Street, all of a half a block from the home plate at Coors Field, and routinely appears in lists of the top 10 beer bars in the U.S. Walking in, you're overwhelmed by the sheer volume of tap handles, both those on service and in racks along the walls. The motto at Falling Rock is, "No crap on tap." This place not only has 75-plus beer taps, it has 75-plus taps of ever-rotating high-quality craft beer. East Coast, West Coast, Colorado, Europe, you name it. Good beer from all around the world ends up on tap or in bottles here. Besides the constantly rotating selection of beers on tap, there's over 130 beers in the bottle, and they make this place a little slice of heaven for a serious beer geek like yours truly. The very ambiance screams beer, with 2,200 empty beer bottles lining the walls of the bar, creating the feel of a beer museum. There is varied seating, booths, tables, bar, and an outdoor patio. We got there at 11:30 on a Friday, pretty early for lunch, so the bar wasn't crowded at all, though it was beginning to fill up as we left about an hour later. We sat in a booth on the bar side and perused the amazing beer menu. The absolutely huge selection included Russian River beers, seldom seen anywhere but around Santa Rosa, California. They were even planning to tap 2 4-gallon kegs of that brewery's Pliny the Younger Triple IPA at 5 p.m. that day. This is the amped-up version of Pliny the Elder Double IPA. Pliny the Younger is only released in February and is available in only a few selected spots besides at the brewery in Santa Rosa, with Falling Rock being one of those. Our server predicted that the 8 gallons of beer would be gone in less than 15 minutes, leaving many disappointed customers. The food was good. I had a nice pastrami sandwich with Swiss cheese, spicy mustard, and grilled onions. Service was great. Perhaps because it was slow, our waiter took plenty of time to chat with us. All the beers I had were absolutely spot on, and the decor and atmosphere were both exceptional. I could see why this bar is where everybody goes after the Great American Beer Festival sessions break up at the nearby Colorado Convention Center. I've been to Denver several times since then, and on each visit, no matter what else is going on, I always make it a point to carve out some time to visit Falling Rock. It's easily one of the top 10 beer bars in the United States, and a lot of folks out there would probably rate it as number one. So if you're a beer lover and you ever find yourself in Denver, make sure you visit this craft beer landmark. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier with Bill Howell, your host, on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. Coming up in our next segment, it's time for the return of beer gear. This is Bill Howell, Drinking on the Last Frontier on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. Hello and welcome to our last segment for this month. Beer Gear is back. When I first did a Beer Gear segment almost a year ago, I led off with talking about some of the magazines out there which cover the craft beer scene. There have been quite a few recent changes in these magazines recently, so I thought for this month's Beer Gear, I would describe the current state of play. First up, All About Beer magazine has announced that it has acquired Draft magazine. Since 2006, Draft magazine has covered the world of beer, food, travel, and culture. All About Beer magazine has been published for 37 years, dating back to the earliest days of the craft beer revolution. All About Beer has discontinued publication of the physical Draft magazine. Subscribers to Draft will receive copies of All About Beer for the remainder of their subscriptions. Draft will continue to build its innovative brand through www.draftmag.com and other digital assets. Second, Beer Advocate magazine, which has been the only monthly beer magazine, has now announced that it is shifting to a quarterly format. Finally, Beer Connoisseur magazine has announced that it has discontinued its print edition. It will now be available in digital format only 6 times a year. I think there's a pretty obvious trend here. Paper magazines are getting more and more rare. If, like me, you would still rather read a magazine in your hand than on your iPad, I'd recommend you strongly consider subscribing to your favorite magazines. If you're someone in the brewing industry, I'd strongly suggest you consider advertising in one or more of them. Otherwise, there might not be physical beer magazines left for any of us to read. In addition to the magazines mentioned above, there are two others which you might want to check out. The first is Northwest Brewing News, a newspaper-style publication which comes out bi-monthly and covers beer news in Northern California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska. If you would like to try it before you buy it, there are generally free copies available in the tap rooms of local breweries. Full disclosure, I write the regular Alaska column for Northwest Brewing News as well as the occasional feature. There is also Craft Beer and Brewing magazine, a glossy bi-monthly which covers both craft beer and homebrewing topics. So if you are a brewer yourself like me, it's another good choice. Whatever your choice, I suggest, as I said, you think about subscribing. That's it for this month's Beer Gear and wraps up this month's show. But before we go, let's hear this month's closing quote in the form of a poem from Edgar Allan Poe. Filled with mingled cream and amber, I will drain that glass again. Such hilarious visions clamber through the chambers of my brain. Quaintest thoughts, queerest fancies, come to life and fade away. What care I how time advances? I am drinking ale today. And on that thought, we'll close this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai, Soldotna. Have a wonderful month. Cheers.
Beers of Alaska, beer on the last frontier. Beers of Alaska, learn about them here.
IPAs, ales, and stouts, pilsners, porters, too. Microbrew, homebrew, any craft you choose. Look before you leap, sip before you drink. What you get isn't always what you think.
Beers of Alaska, learn about them here. Beers of